Fellowship, and let's continue on here with the confrontation between Jesus and these demons. That is going to, of course, end badly for the demons, as it usually does. We're here dealing with, we got down to about point 34 in the first session, dealing with the demonic infiltration into the human race, being part of the time of Noah. And then verse 5 also gives you in Genesis 6. Verse 5 also provides for you the added information that the wickedness of man was great on the earth, and that every intent of the thoughts of his heart was only evil continually. So you had rampant STA activity, and you had demonic infiltration. And so this, obviously, one of the demonic, obviously the demonic infiltration was for the purpose of destroying true humanity, therefore thus rendering the promise of the seed of the woman a moot point. But, of course, God didn't let that happen. 35, for their part in attempting to destroy true humanity by abandoning their celibate status. And this gets into what the Bible reveals about the nature of angels, is that, number one, they're all masculine. But because they're masculine and celibate, people have read into that, well, they can't have sex. Well, that's wrong. They apparently can. Obviously, they have. However, whatever, did they incarnate to do this? I would suspect so. Otherwise, I mean, I would think women, you know, would be kind of freaked out if a demon showed up. So I would assume they took some pleasing form in order to do this. So they're male. They're all male. They were designed to be celibate. And this gets to the reality, of course, that one of the things we see is that with marriage on this planet, in phase three, that's not an issue because everybody will be celibate. And there is something better than sex. It's called absolute fellowship with God and other people. And so there's not sex in heaven. And angels weren't designed to have sex anyway, even though they obviously could. But they weren't designed for that. Well, so because they abandoned their celibate status, God locked them in the lowest part of the abyss, where they still reside today, 2 Peter 2:4. Talks about this, and 2 Peter and Jude are in some ways pretty similar books, kind of complement one another, and they both record kind of similar type information. 2 Peter 2:4, for if God did not spare angels when they sinned, well, this gets to the question, now is he talking about all angels? No, clearly not, because they're not all cast into pits of darkness, for one thing. Some of them are still loose that have sinned, that opted for Satan's viewpoint. But cast them into, it's called hell here in the New American Standard, but it's actually the Greek Tartarus is the actual name of the term, the place where they're cast. And in there, and so Tartarus is the lowest part, apparently, of this place in the planet somewhere. We don't know where it's at. We apparently know there's a shaft that runs down to it. This is all put together by studying lots of different subjects in the Bible in a lot of different places, but you realize, okay, there's this shaft that leads somewhere into the center of the earth, roughly. As best we know, you got the planet Earth. And then down here somewhere in the bowels of the earth, there's this place, and it was divided into compartments. There was Abraham's bosom, which is where believers went when they died, their souls. And then there was torment, which is where unbelievers went when they died. And then down at the very bottom of it, there's a place called Tartarus, where these angels are imprisoned under the worst form of darkness and torment, apparently, that God can devise at this time. And, of course, God knows what it takes to make you miserable, so he knows how to make them miserable as well. So they're down there somewhere in the center of the earth. Well, apparently at some point, we don't know where it's at, there's a shaft to this place. And it apparently has a lock over it, so they can't get out. They're incarcerated there. He not only cast them down there, as he says, he committed them to pits of darkness, reserved for judgment. And also that's recorded in Jude 1:6. Jude 1 should be pretty easy to find since there's only one chapter. and angels who did not keep their own domain. And that was their celibate status sexually, but abandoned their proper abode. They were not to incarnate and to procreate with humans. That was never God's plan. He has kept under in eternal bonds under darkness for the judgment of the great day. So where we get the pit from is if you look in Revelation 9, I believe it is. Then the fifth angel sounded, and I saw a star from heaven which had fallen to earth. The most notable star, obviously, is Satan. And I think Satan is the one that does this. He's given the key to let these demons out. Now, why does God do this? We'll take it up with God. I don't know yet. But he's given the key to let these demons out as a part of God's permissive will. And so we see the, of course, incorrigibility of Satan and his complete lack of regard for the human race, because he's going to turn these demons loose to torment these people. But this all falls into part of his bigger plan, his bigger overall objective, with Antichrist and some other factors. And he opened, the key to the bottomless pit was given to him. And he opened the bottomless pit, and smoke went up out of the pit, like the smoke of a great furnace. And the sun and air were darkened by the smoke of the pit. Then out of the smoke came locusts upon the earth, and power was given to them as the scorpions of the earth have power. They were told not to hurt the grass of the earth. Obviously, these are, and we have to say, cognizant creatures, because they're given commands as to what they are to do and what their limitations are. So, but these demons come out, and they're quite destructive, as we know. I mean, that's one of the things we see with the guy, how destructive they are. And these demons are turned loose, and they torment the people of the earth for 5 months. 5 months only. It's a limited time. And that fact, and that to me squares very well with the fact that the fall of Satan, the destruction of the U.S., and the release of these creatures all essentially occurs probably right at the same, about the same time, in about the third or the first month of the third year of Daniel's 70th week. And then these demons are turned loose for 5 months, and then Antichrist, no doubt, will step in and take credit for their removal. And of course, thus endearing him to every unbeliever out there, because they're only tormenting unbelievers. And in those days, men will seek death and will not find it. Now, if you're that miserable, and like you want to commit suicide, but apparently you won't be successful no matter how you try it. I don't know how God does this. I mean, you shoot a bullet into your brain and it doesn't kill you. It just lodges there and makes you more miserable. How you do it? Got a bullet in my brain. It hurts. How do you think I'm doing? You know, so I don't know how he does it, but I would assume, you know, if people cut their wrists and bleed out, or cut your jugular and bleed out, how's God going to keep these people alive? I don't know. It just says they're going to seek death and will not find it. They will long to die and death flees from them. And then it gives a description of these sort of demonic locusts, as I like to refer to them, the demon locusts. And they're quite hideous. The appearance of the locusts was like horses prepared for battle, and on their heads appeared to be crowns like gold. And their faces were like the faces of men. So if you can, you know, who knows what size or form they'll take. Maybe they'll be small like a locust. I would assume they take that smallish form. But they're clearly at least big enough so that you can make out these features on them. They had crowns like gold, and their faces were like the faces of men. They had hair like the hair of women. The idea, of course, the long hair, the thing here is that this is an absolute rebellion against God. This is why it's recorded here and why the demons like it. And their teeth were like the teeth of lions. They had breastplates like the breastplates of iron. And the sound of their wings was like the sound of many chariots and many horses rushing to battle. And they have tails like scorpions and stings. And in their tails is their power to hurt men for 5 months. And they have a king over them. So apparently down there in the abyss in this Genesis 6 episode, there was a ringleader. One of the head demon that was in charge of this. And his name is known as Abaddon in the Hebrew and Apollyon in the Greek. Both of those have the idea of destroyer. And that's it. So just like in, Ghostbusters, the destroyer comes and takes any form The Stay Puft Marshmallow Man. Well, they're not going to look like the Stay Puft Marshmallow Man. They're going to have the form that's going to be a hideous form. And I think the form is going to do enough to scare people outside of the torment they're going to inflict on these people anyway. So this is what, from the doctrine again, from the prophecies, we kind of know where all this is headed. Well, 36, these demons in the man are all too aware of the fact that they likewise could be imprisoned for their crimes against humanity. 37, the demons clearly considered the idea of being driven out of the man as a form of torture, since they would lose the physical vehicle that allowed them to operate freely in this world. And again, why are the demons so intent on a physical host? I mean, we're not ever really told, we're just told that that's the way it is. And that there is some level at which this apparently makes them feel better. So 38, although it may seem unusual for a demon to invoke God's name as he makes his demand of Jesus, the parallel passage makes the reason clear as to why he does so. 39, the demon appealed to God since he knew that the Son had to be obedient to the Father. And he kind of hoped the Father would rein in his Son here. Hey, make your boy behave. I don't want him messing with me. I implore you by God. And so he invokes God when it's convenient for him. There are people like that. They invoke God when it's convenient. But God does, you know, obviously God's not fooled by any of this, and neither is Jesus. 40, there was an appointed time in which demons would face their judgment. And they seem to have viewed Jesus' arrival on the scene as an illegitimate change in God's plan regarding the time when their sentence would be executed. That actually comes out of one of the footnotes in the Net Bible, that for some reason they see this as a violation of the timing factor. Which, again, tells me that they have a sense of the timing of this stuff. I mean, they kind of know. And again, I can't imagine living with that over your head every day, all your existence. You're miserable, and you're tormented, and you know you're going to a worse place than where you are now. It only gets worse. What if this is as good as it gets? Well, for the demon, literally, that's the way it is. Every day is about as good as it gets, because it's only going to go downhill. So 41, the irony here is not to be missed. These demons had been ready, willing, and able to torment this man to the full extent that they could. And now the speaker wants an assurance from Jesus Christ that he will not torment them. Well, that's horrible. So you want to go out and torment people, but you don't want anybody doing anything to you. I mean, that's typical of this type of mentality. 42, since the demons hate God, they hate those made in God's image. They seek to debase and destroy that image as part of their normal function. 43, verse 8 provides another parenthetical comment, which provides an explanation as to why this demon was asking an oath from Jesus Christ. And that is, for he had been saying to him, this kind of is an explanatory addition, as to why this is all going on. Well, 44, as soon as this man had gotten within earshot, Jesus Christ apparently recognized the situation for what it was. What's your first clue? Naked scabby guy. That's my first clue. There's something up here. I mean, you don't have to be a genius to figure out, well, this guy's not right. And so Jesus obviously is very perceptive in this regard. I think, you know, anybody could figure out he wasn't right. But would you know it was demonic, or would you think it was mental illness? And see, that's where there's a blurring of all of this at some level, because we can't always be sure. But we do know that people, when they're influenced by demons, can exhibit symptoms that we would call mental illness. And some people can have mental illness and apparently not be possessed by demons. The two are distinct, as we know. So, 45, the use of the imperfect lego to say has caused some to believe that Jesus Christ had to issue this command to depart more than once, which does turn out to be the case. And 46, however, there are occasions in narrative literature when the imperfect tense is used just like an aorist indicative. For instance, Matthew 9:24 uses an imperfect, but it seems to just have the force of an aorist indicative. i.e. a single action in past time. And again, the difference would be, I'd say the aorist is kind of, the best example I think I've found at this point, is the aorist is kind of like a snapshot. I mean, it just gives you that point, that moment in time. And the imperfect kind of is more like a motion picture, i.e. it gives you, you see it unfolding, as it were. And we know the difference between, say, a snapshot and a film. Matthew 9:24, if you don't, I want to open a theater. And I only have to show you a snapshot for $8. Okay. Matthew 9:24, he said, leave, for the girl has not died, but is asleep. And they began laughing at him. And the they began laughing is the imperfect there. And just really has the force of they laughed at him. I mean, obviously the laughter went on for a little period of time. As you would understand, nobody just laughs like, huh? It's not much of a laugh. If you've got that bad of a laugh, you really shouldn't be laughing anyway. So, you know, obviously laughter goes on. So, you know, that's the reason for the imperfect. But it still just has the sense, though, of they laughed at him. And also Mark 5:30. That's coming up later in the chapter. Immediately, Jesus, perceiving in himself that power had proceeding from him, had gone forth. He turned around to the crowd and said, who touched my garments? And let me look, but I think the gone forth is the power having gone forth thing is the one I'm looking for here. Let's see. Turn to the crowd. Oh, saying. That's it. Saying. He said. It's. But the reason why it's an imperfect, again, it has kind of the force of an aorist, but he asked it repeatedly. The woman, as we're going to see, didn't step forth right away and was not real forthcoming about this. And so he did say it over and over again, he repeated it a number of times, who touched me? And of course the disciples get kind of enough of this and they say, it's crowded here, there's a bunch of people touching you. And so they're a little put out with Jesus, and their question kind of betrays that they're put out with him. So again, once again, they don't recognize he's God and he knows what he's doing. You get to see that in the disciples. Well, 47, additionally, Luke's account uses the verb parangelo. That means to issue an authoritative command, to issue a directive about something that has to be done. And he uses it in the aorist tense, and that is the word I command you. So 48, nevertheless, the imperfect here should not be construed as an aorist. That should be an aorist. It should be understood as a repeated actions on the part of Jesus Christ. And as we will see, there was a reason that Jesus had to issue the command for the demon to depart more than once. And 50, even though such was the case, Jesus obviously did not doubt or falter due to the difficulty he faced. He continued to command the demon to leave, and the outcome was never in doubt. But again, as we were discussing on break, this appears to be another one of Satan's little ploys in his chess match against Jesus. He takes these demons and says, okay, I want you to try this, I want you to try this. We'll use this opening here, if you're familiar with chess, and then we will use this attack, we will use the Snyder Gambit, that's the, you know, synonym for Peace River Gambit. And so whatever we have to try, and so the demons apparently have to obey all this. And so here they are in this guy, and again, the interaction is, it's kind of my sense, that the guy himself sees these people coming and says, okay, good, more suckers. And he goes running down to get them. But at some point in the proceedings, the demons are like, whoa, we know who this is. And so they're not necessarily that keen on all of this. And, of course, they're begging for mercy now all of a sudden. And the guy's consciousness sort of passes into the background in all of this. I mean, he's still there conscious. But the demons are clearly in the forefront now by this time. In verse 9, he was asking him, what is your name? And he said to him, my name is Legion, for we are many. And this Kai that he was asking him is... Eperotao, E-P-E-R-O-T-A-O. That's the imperfect active indicative. He was asking, or he kept asking. Apparently the demon was not forthcoming about the situation. Well, duh. I think I can figure out the demons are going to fall under, since Satan's the liar and the father of lying, the demons are going to be pretty good at lying too. So he kept asking. He asked him on more than one occasion, what is your name? Because the demon wasn't answering, apparently. And not that the demon could resist forever, but obviously this is a little bit of a power play here on his part. He's trying to say, okay, I don't have to answer you. I'm in charge, not you. You're not the boss of me. Oh, yes, I am. I'm the Son of God. I'm the boss of everybody. And so so these demons, you know, they have to do Satan's will, and they have to go up, and whatever the conflict is, they're going to have to fight, although they know they're already beat. So they're kind of inside the guy, probably, as it were, shaking in their boots, thinking, I wish we didn't have to do this today. But they're going to have to go through it, and then as it turns out, they're going to get cast out anyway. So one of the things we see is that these demons didn't always go gently into that good night. They were ready to fight it out to the end. They didn't necessarily, even though they knew the outcome wasn't in doubt, they weren't going to admit it. They've adopted the position, we might be able to pull this off. But I guess how would you go on if you couldn't? I mean, you would have to kind of think like that. Well, I might have a chance this time against Jesus. Good luck. So he kept asking him, i.e. the demon in this case, not the man, what? You got the interrogative pronoun, the nominative singular of tis, which is, again, who, what, or which, depending upon context. When it's a neuter, it's going to be what or which. What is your name? The word onoma means a name or a designation. O-N-O-M-A. What is the name of you? To you, a dative of Sue, actually. And he says, again, the historical present here, the demon is now speaking, and he says, the demon, to him, Jesus. Autos, the pronoun autos is used here, indirect object. He says to him, Legion is my name. L-E-G-I-O-N. And obviously that's just transliterated over into the English. Four times this word's used. It's a Roman legion, was a military unit of about 6,000 men. Plus, there was additional auxiliary support. So, a legion really comprised more than that. I mean, it could comprise less, but generally speaking, we're talking about a massive force here. We're not simply talking about a few demons. We're talking of thousands of them, probably, in this one guy. He says, Legion is my name. Legion is the name to me. Because, and interestingly, he speaks in the first person. Name is, again, onoma, nominative, neuter, singular. To me, the dative of ego, singular, to me. Because, introduction, conjunction here, hati, introduces a clause here. Because many, we are. And then he shifts to the plural. Polis is the adjective, great, much, or many. And then we are is the present indicative, first person plural of the to be verb, I mean. Verse 9 here, exposition, point 1, when dealing with the issue of demon possession. It is not always clear when Jesus Christ is addressing the individual and when he is addressing the demons within. Again, there's a blurring here of consciousnesses that goes on. And I don't think anybody, you know, really is going to be able to explain it perfectly. But clearly there is a time when the man's consciousness is in the forefront and a time when the demon consciousness is in the forefront. And that, obviously, I think, depends on the demon. The demon makes those determinations when he's just going to overrule the guy and just do what he wants. Verse 8, point 2, does make evident to whom Jesus was speaking in this case. Jesus Christ has clearly turned from the man to address the demon he recognized was residing within the man. 3, there is no reason for Jesus Christ to think that this encounter with the demonic realm was going to be any different than he had experienced previously. And 4, at every preceding exorcism, the demon in question would be recognized as being present and commanded to leave, which each demon always did. So Jesus knows he's got power over these creatures. So this to him is a little bit, I'd have to say, he had to be a little puzzled in his humanity. Why is this not working? And it's not because of a lack of power and all of that. And what he figures out is, oh, there's more, there's a bunch of demons here. There's not just one. And apparently, in many cases, now if he had cast out numerous demons before, we're not told. This stands out here clearly in Mark as being a major case because Mark devotes a lot of space to this one incident. We know that Mark's an action gospel because he's trying to show Jesus as a servant, the obedient servant, which will eventually kind of morph into the suffering servant. But in the beginning stages, he's just the obedient servant. And so Mark's interested in action, and so he tends to move from one event to the other real quick. Mark, but here, I mean, he takes 20 verses to devote to this one incident, which is very long according to Mark's standards. So this incident occupied a real prime place in Mark's thinking as to, you know, as to what's going on here and the significance of it. And he tells you how significant he thinks it is by how much he writes about it. Which, again, this had to be an astonishing thing to be standing there witnessing. So Jesus always knew that the demons have to leave, but they don't leave. Well, he has to kind of work through this and figure it out. He has to walk by faith in his humanity just like you and I do. Otherwise, the test isn't fair. And believe me, if the test wasn't fair during the incarnation, we would have heard about it by now. Don't think Satan's going to let this one go by. If God had somehow given his son all these advantages that you and I don't have as humans, he suffered the same limitations we face. And certain times, we don't know what's going on. We can have a pretty good clue sometimes, but other times we just don't know. And so in that case, we have to walk by faith. But most people tend to want to walk by sight because that's the way the world works. Everybody walks by what they see rather than what they believe to be true. So five, however, in this case, Jesus Christ recognized that something was not going according to the way it should have been. He knew that the demons did have to obey him when he issued a command to depart. Six, nevertheless, even after commanding the demon to leave, the man continued to exhibit signs of demon possession, which Jesus Christ recognized. And seven, having determined there must be some reason the command was not being obeyed in the manner it should, Jesus Christ seeks more information so he will figure out how to continue to deal with the situation. And that, again, obviously one of the things you see here, I think Jesus is not, a lot of times when you see Jesus ask questions, it's not because he doesn't know the answer. And if you see God asking questions, he definitely knows the answer. It's only rhetorical. He knows the answer. But here I think Jesus in his humanity doesn't know the answer to this one. And I think that's why he asks. This is one of the few times you see Jesus, I think, asking a question. But this is very important. When Mark paints this picture of Jesus that we're going to see, by the time we see all the end of it all, one of the things we see is the limitations of his humanity as well. And that comes across here, I think. What is your name? Obviously, Jesus, I don't think he knew this one in his humanity. How could he? I mean, do you know the names of any demons? I don't. And, you know, and weird, I mean, you can go study. There's these esoteric places, and they'll tell you, oh, we know the names of angels and demons. We've got them all figured out. Well, it's not biblical. So six, nevertheless, even after commanding, again, the demon to leave, this guy still... clearly demon-possessed. Jesus can see it. And eight, this provides a good application for believers to emulate. When one is confronted with a situation that challenges his doctrine, he should not panic, but seek more information and continue with his application. Most people, what they do is when they're confronted with challenging information, they freak out. And they, you know, why? What is that gaining you by freaking out? It doesn't gain anything. In fact, it neutralizes you. Because you're either under panic or fear or whatever it is. You're neutralized at that point. Jesus doesn't lose his cool. He doesn't say, oh my God, what's happening? All right, let's work through this. He stays calm and deals with it. And you see that in the life of Christ. You see that even when confronted with situations that he might not understand, he didn't freak out. He didn't run in the opposite direction. He didn't say, oh, God's abandoned me. Well, no, none of that's true. So when something, again, challenges the doctrine, just keep on keeping on. Don't let it throw you. And you're going to face these things in life. You're going to face challenges to your faith. That's a part of testing. That's going to go on. God tests your faith. And obviously there are things that test your faith apart from God. But we do know that God allows testing for a specific purpose, i.e. spiritual growth and vindication of the doctrine ultimately. And then, of course, we benefit from all of that with SG3. That comes up as a part of that application, the reward for it. So nine, the believer that is not grounded in doctrine and lacks confidence in what he does know may become rattled when confronted with difficult situations. I see that all the time. People just freak out. Well, this is just a little test. Come on. Good God, this is just momentary light affliction. Whatever it is, it's momentary light affliction. You say, but some of the afflictions are heavier. Yeah, they are. Granted, from a human perspective, from the divine perspective, it's all momentary light affliction. If you look in 2 Corinthians 4, Paul alludes to this. And Paul doesn't freak out. I mean, he tells you about all these things they went through, that they suffered in some ways. And again, this is where context is critical to interpretation. If you just take a verse and isolate on it, momentary light affliction, verse 17, is producing for us an eternal weight of glory. Well, but what is the momentary light affliction? Well, he tells you back in verse 8 is where he begins all this, or verse 7 actually. We have this treasure in earthen vessels. What is the treasure? Bible doctrine. It's the power of the Word of God residing within us. And then, of course, as that doctrine grows and matures into, as the new man grows up, Christ is formed in you. So you become a little walking Jesus in this body of flesh. That's essentially the goal of Christianity in a nutshell. God multiplies Jesus by making a bunch of little Jesuses. And that's what we're supposed to be. And obviously he does all this knowing that we're sinful, that we're fallible, that we're going to let him down, and all these other factors. And that's why Paul says, we have this treasure in earthen vessels. The earthen vessel is insignificant. It doesn't matter. I mean, it's like and I know everybody's proud of their kids and all that, you know, but kids make these little deals, you know, they had to make a little ashtray or something in shop, and, you know, this little, or some pottery project. I guess it wasn't ashtray. It was ashtrays in the 50s and 60s. You know, in the 60s and 70s, it became bong pipes. Then in the 80s, it was disco beads. Well, so you make this little pottery thing and you bring it home. Well, it's insignificant, really. Now, to the kid, it's a great deal. Look what my 8-year-old did. Okay, well, it's insignificant. And we're insignificant at that level. The whole flesh problem is, and that's why God does it this way. Because his plan still has to be approached by faith. I mean, if I was walking a billboard and glowed in neon and was 8.5 feet tall, well, people could pick me out as being something doctrinally. But then you get the package as it is, just like all of us. And it's this, quote, insignificant package. But can people figure out, and the only way you're going to know I'm any different than any other person is to figure out what I think. And then obviously part of that gets into the revelation factor. You can only know what I think to the extent that I let you. I mean, obviously I can keep things, you never know, just like you can. And we all do that. So we have this treasure in earthen vessels so that the surpassing greatness of the power will be of God and not of ourselves. I thank God every day that, you know, he doesn't rely on me, the weak link in the chain, to get his plan accomplished. It all depended on Ron. Well, that's a heavy burden for anybody to bear. And we don't have to bear it. That's the beauty of it. And he still deals with us in grace, even when we let him down and fail. He responds with mercy. But we keep on trucking. We keep on plowing with the positive volition thing and keep pursuing his plan. Well, obviously, that's going to get you a long way with God. This on again, off again junk, never. The double-minded man is unstable in all his ways. And we see that. So the reality is, again, you mean we discussed the issue of mental illness, but the double-minded man has to be mentally ill. He's got two minds, for God's sake. He's schizophrenic. And he's unstable, very unstable, highly unstable. But if you're committed to doctrine, well, you're not unstable. You become a stable person. And then Paul talks about his affliction. We are afflicted in every way. But we are not crushed, perplexed. There are things we don't understand. There are things that bother us, but not despairing. We haven't lost hope. Persecuted, but not forsaken. Even if everybody's against us, God's still for us. Struck down, but not destroyed. We may have things go against us. We have all these problems we face. You may take a bad turn financially or physically or otherwise. But yet, here we are. At the end of the day, still trucking. Always caring about in the body the dying of Jesus. This is the aspect of fighting your STA. As you put to death through the deeds of the flesh through the Spirit, You die in some ways to your own goals, your own ambitions, your own plans. And you recognize, okay, God's got a much bigger plan, and I need to worry about that. That's where I need to be consumed. So he says momentary. Now he's talked about all this. He says momentary light affliction. Well, he's talking about the problems first, in a general sense. He's talking about the problems inherent in the ministry. In context, that's what he's talking about. But by application, of course, this is true of all believers. We all face inherent problems. For momentary light affliction is producing for us an eternal weight of glory beyond all comparison. And so we look at that. We look not at the things which are seen. But this is the way the world works. The world only works off of what it can see and hear and smell and taste and touch. And if it's not physical, if it's not tangible to them, it's not real. And so they mock of people, and I've heard it, you know, I've heard it, oh, you people live by faith. Yeah, so do you. You just may not know it, but you do it. These people go to bed at night, you know what, in faith. They don't go to bed thinking, what if I'm going to die? I mean, can you imagine? I remember when I was a little kid, that was always like a fear of going to sleep. I remember having that when I was 4 or 5. I got old enough to be kind of conscious of what's going on. So my mom said, look, you don't need to be afraid, just say this prayer. And, you know, and now I lay me down to sleep. I give the Lord my soul to keep. Please don't kill me in my sleep. No. But that's the gist of the prayer, you know. And, you know, as a little kid, you don't want to go to sleep and die. And so, but I was like, okay, well, God has to take care of me. Even from an early age, I mean, I didn't have a great Christian upbringing, as it were. But even from an early age, I thought, well, yeah, God's got to take care of you, I guess, really, is kind of what it boils down to. It's really beyond you at some level. We know, for instance, say bodily exercise profits a little while, i.e. while you're alive. But, I mean, what exercises are you going to do for your heart, your lungs, your kidneys, your pancreas, your spleen, your appendix to keep them safe? I mean, as I understand it, if your appendix bursts, you're very possibly going to die. I mean, you can. But how do you what exercise do you do for the appendix to keep it safe? Well, there isn't one. And so, you know, and it just obviously God has to take care of so much of this. And people, you know, they walk around and they're arrogant. Oh, I've got it all together. I've got it figured out. Oh, really? So we don't look at the things that are seen. We look at the unseen things. See, we try to get believers to focus on SG3, not on the here and now, on their eternal future. Because we believe that to be the significant thing. We got to get people to focus on doctrine, not on their fears. And not on their lack of faith that God can provide for them. So, again, when believers get rattled, they lose their confidence and they freak out. Well, 10 here, rather. Nonetheless, one should be willing to firmly stand his doctrinal ground in the angelic conflict. Seek further insight where you lack information. And faith rests the matter in question. Ephesians 6, 11 through 14. And the key thing here in this passage to me is not simply who our enemies are. That we fight, and we know from the scripture, we fight battles on three fronts. The world, the flesh, and the devil. Your own sin nature, and all that. But the key word in all of this is to me not just who we fight and all our armor and all of this, but the key verbs in here to me are stand. Put on the full armor of God so that you will be able to stand firm. That's the goal, is to be able to stand firm against the schemes of the devil. This tells me a couple of things. Number one, I don't have to go on the offensive against Satan. That's not defined as my job. My job is to stand my ground doctrinally in the angelic conflict and let the chips fall where they may. And so I may be able to stand against the schemes, and we recognize Satan has these schemes. Again, using the chess analogy, he has various openings, mid-games, end-games he can use against you. And he knows what these are, and he's a genius. And he's probably way ahead of you in terms of steps. And way ahead of me and all of us. For our struggle is not against flesh and blood. But again, verse 13, take up the full armor of God so that you will be able to resist. And having done everything, stand firm. There's the verb again. Stand. Stand your ground. Know what the truth is. Get oriented to it and hold your ground no matter what comes at you. Whatever is thrown at you in the angelic conflict. And again, I know this is all easy to say in the nice deal of Bible class where we're all in fellowship and nobody's being tested right this second. You think, I'm being tested, I hate your voice. Okay, well, if you are being tested, that's your test to bear then. And so you have to figure out, okay, I need to know what I need to know, and then I need to stand firm with it. I don't need to be, you know, this vacillation, this double-minded approach to stuff doesn't work. And again, if you don't maintain a posture in the angelic conflict, Satan knows your weaknesses. He knows where to strike. He knows where you live. And 11, as the pre-incarnate Son of God, the second person, well, I did want to mention it, though, verse 14 again. You see the verb, stand firm. Stand firm, therefore. Well, on account of all this, what's the goal? Stand firm. I think I kind of picked that up. He uses it three times in like four verses. I think he's trying to emphasize something. What is it? Running? No, standing firm. Okay, that's pretty clear. So 11 is the pre-incarnate God. The second person had named each of the angels. Isaiah 40:26. However, the humanity of Jesus was not privy to this information. And he did not recognize the speaker. If the humanity... See, this is where there can't be any cheating. So if I'm not allowed to know the names of the angels, would Jesus be allowed to in his humanity? I don't think so. But now, can he ask an angel what his name is? And does he have to tell him? Yeah, apparently. Isaiah 40:26. Here, lift up your eyes on high and see who has created these stars. The one leads forth their host by number. He calls them all by name. Because of the greatness of his might and his strength and his power, not one of them is missing. And this is one of those passages which certainly appears to have a dual reference to both stars and angels. That the stars aren't really led forth. They are in a fixed orbit, as it were. They are fixed in their positions. But angels are not, obviously. Angels can move around. And so this is one of those passages. But the key point is, he knows them all. He knows the names of all. And again, from our perspective, as we look up at night, we think all we're seeing is stars, essentially. I mean, we recognize scientifically that there are planets and other things up there, including the space station. I see them advertised on the news. Hey, if you get up at 6 in the morning, you can see the space station. Woo! I didn't get up at 6 to watch it, as you might imagine. So again, but does his humanity know all this? Well, no. No, he's not privy to that. Nor does he need to be. Do you need to know the names of the demons to run your Christian race? No. It doesn't concern me, really. At 12, the use of the imperfect form of the verb epero-tao indicates Jesus was asking this question repeatedly, presumably receiving a different answer each time and possibly from a different demon. 13, the term is a strengthened form of erotao, which means to question someone. It is used in a legal sense of interrogating someone in the course of an investigation, and that's kind of how we see it used here. I mean, Jesus is the interrogator, but there's not going to be any good cop, bad cop. He's just the cop. And he's going to get to the bottom of this. He's going to find out. 14, as we will see, this encounter very much has the character of a legal showdown and a military battle. 15, Jesus Christ does not ask the demon his name because he bought into the prevailing view that when one knew the name of a person and named it, that he had power over that person. I don't see any evidence of that in the life of Christ at all. I mean, I know that was sort of the prevailing Jewish view, but... To name the name. And we see how important the name was when you're dealing with demons, because we saw it there in that Seven Sons of Sceva deal. I know Jesus' name. I know Paul's name. Who are you? Well, names are real important, obviously. Why? Because the name comes to stand for the person. So when we talk about the name of God, we're talking about God himself. 16, if Jesus really needed information about each demon, he could have easily have demanded to know the name, rank, and serial number of each demon on every occasion. But that we don't see him doing that. That doesn't appear to be a matter that really concerns him. He just knows they're demons, they're tormenting mankind, and he's here to set the captives free. I mean, if Jesus wanted to know, he could stop on every occasion and interrogate the demon. But that wasn't part of God's will for his humanity. And you have to recognize he's just doing what the will of God is for his life. 17, from Jesus' perspective, it would seem that the demon did not depart as he should have. So he seeks to find out which demon it is, since that might provide an explanation. 18, the reality is that Jesus Christ could command the demon singular to leave the man, or would. And one of the demons, likely the weakest of those possessing the man, would vacate. I would assume they left here in order of ascending strength. The demons that were still in the body were kind of holding out. Maybe we can hold on to this deal. And if he's going to cast out demons, all right, you're going. You're the weak one. Kick him out. Kind of the bottom end, you know. You're at the end of the totem pole there. You're at the low end of the chain, of the food chain. So you go. So you have to leave. Well, 19, however, the man had become to be inhabited by so many demons that nothing effectively changed when 2, 3, 4 or more demons departed. And 20, as soon as he spoke, one demon would leave permanently. But there were so many left that the man's behavior did not change, and this had been repeated a number of times. We're not told how many. But certainly enough for where Jesus knows, okay, something's weird here. Something's going on that's out of the norm. And I need to figure out what it is. In 21, although these demons were just as subject to the authority of Jesus Christ as any others he had encountered, the singular command, and that's where you don't see it so much unless you look at the Greek, the verb in the Greek has the person attached to it. And the singular command, you come out of the man, the second person singular, would allow a loophole. Okay, one of us will leave. But not all of us. We're not all leaving. We don't have to. He only commanded one demon to leave, therefore one demon leaves. And again, I would suspect it's the weakest demon, the one that, you know, they can run over. So only one unclean spirit left at a time. In 22, this is the reason for the use of the imperfect form of lego, he was saying in verse 8. When Jesus Christ commanded a demon to leave, one did. In 23, however, this had not resulted in the man being effectively rid of all the demons. And so Jesus had to repeat his command. In 24, however, every time he would issue the command to depart, a demon would depart. Nevertheless, it needed to be repeated before another demon would vacate his host. The demons kind of had this little legal loophole here, and they picked up on it. Well, obviously, you know, when you're in a fight for your life, you're probably going to look for every loophole you can find to try to get out of this. And they're in a fight, not necessarily, quote, for their life, but for what they perceive to be their well-being is being attacked by Jesus. And they don't care for that. So 25, Jesus now recognizes that this is not a normal situation, but a matter of multiple possession. Therefore, he demands to know the identity of those inside the man. In 26, one would suspect that many of the demons sought to remain in the background, hoping to evade being cast out of the man, since they love darkness and often seek to mask their activities. Demons are not, you know, straightforward. This is one of the reasons why believers, we encourage positive believers to be straightforward, to be people of your word, to be kind of the what you see is what you get kind of person. And some people are turned off by that, I understand, but guess what? There's no other real way to live, I don't think. You just need to be, at some level, transparent. But that's not demons. Again, they're kind of back there, as it were, lurking in the shadows, hoping not to be noticed. Hey, we're not here. We're invisible. And guess what? They didn't fool Jesus. Jesus figures it out. He works through this. 27, nevertheless, they would all finally have to submit to the superior power before them. So there came a point at which someone had to tell the truth. That's one of the things we see here. Jesus has the power and ability to force the truth out of these people, these demons specifically. He has the ability to command this, and they eventually have to submit to it, whether they like it or not, and we know they would not like it. So 28, therefore, since it is evident that there would be one most powerful demon in the man, whoever it was, it is he that now acts as a spokesman for the entire group. And our time is up, so we will stop there, and we'll see what all he has to say and do. Unfortunately, he can't win, but that's not going to stop him from trying, of course. Thank you, Father, for the opportunity to assemble together with Positive Volition. We thank you for the power in your word, and pray that you would sanctify this information to our souls. In Christ's name, amen.